We've been talking for a while now, and I just want to talk a bit about Vietnam and about your experiences in Vietnam, because I'm really interested in what your life is like in Vietnam and what your thoughts are on Vietnam and the Vietnamese political system.
Oh, and, yeah.
So how long have you lived in Vietnam?
Altogether about 6 years now, if you add it all up.
Hmm. So do you have like a permanent residence or like a work visa? What's your situation there?
I have like yearly visas. I do it all by the book. A lot of people live here kind of like quasi-legally, but I'm more like on paper. I have like a visa, yearly visa that I have to renew. And it's not that hard, actually. It's actually very easy to legally immigrate to Vietnam, which is kind of ironic since I'm from the United States of America. But yeah, it's pretty easy to live here as a foreigner if you just follow all the little rules. There's not a lot of rules. Like you just pay, basically the way you get a visa in the US, if you're a US citizen or if you're from a developed country, for most countries, you just pay a little stamping fee at the airport. You get a visa letter and you can live here. So it's not that hard, really.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I know in most Asian countries, it's very difficult to actually become a citizen if you were not born there or you don't have parents from there. Is it possible to become a citizen of Vietnam?
Yes, and I'm considering it. I'm actually, I guess you could say at this point, I'm planning it. But here's the way it works, and it's amazing. So here's the process. You pay like, I think it's a $20 fee. You have to like kind of prove to them that you can find gainful employment, and it's not like it's all kind of an interview process. And from what I understand, because I've talked to people who have become citizens here, it's not really that hard. The hardest part is, it's really the only barrier, is you have to speak Vietnamese at like an intermediate level. You have to basically speak it well enough that you can have a conversation with the interviewer and get through that process. So like, as of right now, even though I've lived here for 6 years and I've studied Vietnamese for about 6 years, I still suck at it. But I'm planning to start, like I'm moving to Da Nang soon, and I'm going to actually start going to a school like five days a week and really starting to learn it. But I can become proficient in Vietnamese, it will be very easy for me to become a citizen, actually. They don't have any kind of like requirements beyond the fact that you speak Vietnamese and you don't have a criminal record, and you know, that's basically it. So yeah, I do hope to become a Vietnamese citizen eventually.
I'm curious, how did you meet Luna?
So we met like we met online like on a dating app, basically.
Cool.
And but yeah, it's just kind of funny because on our first date, we just talked about like she was reading a book by Stephen Hawking, and I was like, "Holy shit, you're a nerd!" And she was like, "Yeah." And then we talked about like Star Trek and Harry Potter and you know just all the nerdy things. And that's basically it. And then collectively together, we have watched every single episode of Star Trek. I'm very proud of that accomplishment. It's like over 760 hours.
Wait. So you say Star Trek, do you mean like every show?
Every show. We've watched every episode of every show and every film. We are complete completionists of Star
Trek.
That's
incredible.
Wow. So
what's the best
long
one?
3 years. What's the best? Oh.
The best episode is the one where Picard goes crazy.
All of them.
This is pretty much all of them. No, I'm kidding.
I like the original series myself. I'm personally an original series
person.
Hell
yeah.
Luna, I can't remember. I think she likes Deep Space Nine the most, I think. Yeah, I think she likes Deep Space Nine the most, perhaps. It might be maybe Voyager, but
I'm surprised none of you would say Next Generation.
We like the Next Generation, but honestly, the Next Generation, oh my gosh, please don't get me started. I will, but the Next Generation is like, for me, and I think Luna might share, is it doesn't have as much of the like long story arcs and character arcs. It's a lot more kind of episodic.
Yeah, it's more episodic. Yeah.
Which I know the original series is like super episodic, but I just love the triumvirate of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. I just can't.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll ever have that kind of like on-screen chemistry duplicated ever again. It was just like something about when those three are like together. It's just amazing to me. And I don't know what it is. I'm just a fanboy of, and I know that like William Shatner's kind of a shithead, and I know that. I know all that stuff. Leonard Nimoy was pretty cool. Anyway, I don't know. It's just the characters are what really does it for me when it comes to Star Trek. So
and the movies that came out of the original cast are just incredible.
Oh yeah, they're the most like the original series movies are actually like watching an episode of Star Trek. Like they actually have really strong like sci-fi philosophical yeah. themes, whereas the Next Generation movies, they're just kind of like action movies.
Bad. I mean,
yeah, I'm not super yeah. into those. Yeah.
No. Anyway, sorry.
Sorry. Yeah, I could literally, we could turn this into a Star Trek podcast if we're not careful. So.
Next time you're on, it's all Star Trek.
I'm on board. I'm 100% on board with that.
I mean, it's keeping with the like with the theme. What are movies like in Vietnam? Which movies do you get? Are there a lot of locally produced movies in Vietnam, or do you get a lot of Chinese movies? I know you probably get a lot of American movies at like cinemas and stuff, right?
Yeah, you know what's funny is that when I first came here, it seemed like when I went to the movie theater, it was like maybe 80% or 70% like U.S. movies mostly, and then it would be like maybe 15 or 20% Korean movies. Korean movies are like the big thing in Asia right now, all over. Like Korean music, huh. K-pop, and Korean movies, and Korean TV shows. That's kind of like much more influential than U.S. media right now for a lot of people in Asia. Not just in Vietnam, but like also in China and, you know, all over the place. Thailand, the Philippines, people watch a lot of the Korean like soap operas and stuff. So when I first moved here, it was like maybe 60, 70% U.S. and then like 10, 15% Korean. And then the rest were like maybe Vietnamese movies and a few Chinese films or whatever. But lately, for the last few years, the Vietnamese film industry has completely exploded. And now when I go to the movie theater, typically 50% or more of the movies will be Vietnamese movies. It's like they've wow. really kind of built their own like kind of film culture here. And it's amazing. And the movies are really good. There's a really good movie. Here, I'll look up the name of it while I'm talking. But in Vietnamese, it's called... but anyway, it's an action movie that stars a woman, and it's like her trying to get her kid back. The amazing thing about this film, I want to do a video on this eventually, is that it's like an action movie that has a female lead that is completely devoid of the male gaze. So like this character is never sexualized. Hai Phung. It's called Hai Phung in Vietnamese. So now I can probably find it on Google.
Hai Phung.
Yeah. But it's like so amazing because it's like this strong. Yeah, if you want to watch it, it's on Netflix actually. It's called Fury in English. The English title is Fury, F-U-R-I-E. But you watch this movie, it's like amazing because it's like, and the thing about it is Vietnam has a long history of strong women. I mean, like it was a matriarchal society before they got colonized by China. They had like female gods there. They had like queens. There's a very famous pair of women queens that some people say might have been lesbians. There's a really strong theory behind that. But they're called the Hai Ba Chung, the Chung sisters, or the, you know, yeah. And they were like female warrior queens. And of course, you know, we all know that in the Vietnam War, you know, women soldiers were critical and they had women generals and all that kind of thing. So it was really interesting to see that kind of play out in a film where you have an action movie and it's this woman and she's like fighting through the whole thing. You know, in an American movie, we have action movies that star women, but they're always like, you know, like heaving breasts and tight clothes and all that stuff. Like
yeah.
this woman is wearing a very like conservative drapey, like shirt the whole time. There's even a scene where she falls into a river. And she gets out of the river and, you know, you think I'm like, okay, here comes the sex scene, or, you know, like she'll be like sexy and dripping and wet t-shirt kind of thing. But it's like, no, there's like nothing sexual about it. And it was just amazing to me because I've never seen an action movie with a female lead or with any female character that's not like overtly sexualized. I just thought that was a fascinating little side note, but yeah, but they have a lot of great films, really great films.
I just looked it up and apparently it's the highest grossing Vietnamese film in Vietnamese history.
I wouldn't be surprised that's by cool. that. Yeah. Yeah. It was a big deal here. Like they had all the, you know how they have the little, like, don't use your phone in the theater things. Like that was a Hai Phung, like they produced it with that actress and she like rode into the theater on a motorbike and stuff. It was pretty cool.
That's so cool. Yeah. I will say, though, in defense of American cinema, they have really dialed down the hypersexuality of women in the last 10 years or so. I'm guessing also just out of fear. Like, I think they really want to sexualize women, but I think they kind of feel like they can't anymore.
Yeah.
Because of backlash.
Yeah, but you can notice. I mean, like, well, the I think a great, like, if you really want to see that, just look at the movie poster for the old Tomb Raider movie. And then look at the new Tomb Raider movie. Like, they've definitely desexualized it a lot. But even then, like, if you watch the new Tomb Raider movie, there's definitely, like, sexualization going on.
So much. And the Charlie's Angels movie looks like such a mess, too. Yeah. Just everything sexualized. And yeah.
But watch this movie, Fury. It's, like, it'll blow your mind. Because, like, I watched the whole thing. I actually didn't realize it until, like, after we finished watching the movie. And I was like, what was so weird about that movie? And I was trying to figure it out. And I was like, holy shit, there was just like no sexualization. So then I watched it again and I was like, oh my God, it's totally, there's not a frame in the movie where she sexualized it. I just thought that was so fascinating.
That is fascinating. Yeah. And that's just such an ingrained part of watching a movie. Yeah.
It's funny because it's such a like a low bar.
Yes.
Like, it's such a small thing to be impressed by. Like, wow, this movie did not like turn the main character into a sex object. Yeah. Like, wow.
Wow, this movie didn't kill any animals for the fun of it on set. Wow.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I guess this is the last thing I'll say about this, but there is one scene, and this is interesting too. There's one scene where it shows her past and she like used to be, I don't know if it's like kind of, it's kind of coded that she was a prostitute. And so she's in this like kind of like bar with all these like girls and they're wearing like kind of sexy clothing, but it's very like sad. Mm. You know, it's like, it's like the women are all very clearly being kind of like abused and they're not like, like the clothes they're wearing are these kind of like cheap, you know, like kind of, it's not really sexy. It's just kind of sad. It's like a depressing kind of sexuality, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's not titillating at all. It's like, I feel really bad for these women that are in the situation, and it's shot that way, you know, like they never do like the pan up or anything. It's just very like stark. This is what it's actually like to be like a, you know, essentially a victim of like the sex trade industry. So it's, I don't know. That was fascinating, kind of a feminist, but it's not overtly feminist either. It's a good movie. Good movie. Good flick.
Yeah.
Is it true that in Vietnam, the Vietnam War is called the American War?
Yes. Yeah. Which is kind of awkward for me. but, you know, when I first came to visit here, I went to Saigon. I lived in Saigon originally, and I went to the what used to be called the American War Crimes Museum. And now they call it like the War Relic Museum. And that's the other thing. It's like, it's really actually fair. Like, it's a fair portrayal. Like, they actually showed some, like, images of war crimes that the North committed. It wasn't like just a totally anti-American, you know, propaganda kind of thing. It was like, this is the reality of the war. And of course there was plenty of American war crimes to like put on display. There was no shortage of that, but it wasn't like just a total attack. And there was a huge, like one of the biggest exhibits was about Americans that were like protesting against the war. So they had like photographs of people that were protesting, and they had like actual signs that people were holding up, and like, a few pictures of Jane Fonda and that kind of thing. So it was like, it was pretty, there's no demonization of the United States of American people in Vietnam ever. Yeah. And I thought when I first moved here, when I first visited here, I was terrified that they would be sort of, that they would hate me, you know, because I come from this country that inflicted so much harm on them. The United States dropped more bombs on Vietnam than all of the combined countries of World War II dropped. Through the entire theater of war. So, so I really thought like there would be a lot of animosity towards me, but I can tell you this, I have not once in all the years that I've been here, I have never felt like somebody had any kind of animosity towards me for being an American.
Not even in the museum. Nope. Nobody sent you any dirty looks or anything.
Not at all. No. I mean, and I have talked to victims of the war. I have talked to veterans of the war. You know, I've talked to people who are in the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh actually is what you would actually call them in Vietnam. I've talked to a woman who, just real quick side story, this one old lady I talked to, she was a young girl during the war in like 1970. She lived in Hanoi, and she was walking down the street in the middle of Hanoi, and she was with her best friend, and she remembers like she saw a dog crossing the street. And that's the last thing she remembers. And then like blacked out. And the next thing she knew, a bomb had fallen like really close by. And she said that, you know, all of the blood and the gore in the street, she couldn't tell what was the dog and what was her best friend.
Oh my.
You know, and she tells me this story. And I asked her like, aren't you angry at the United States of America or whatever? And she's like, well, no, I'm very angry at like Richard Nixon and at like the war machine of the United States of America. And I'm angry at like the government that made this happen, but they understand. Mm. She knows she's not like a college educator or anything. This is a very working class person, but she knows that like the people, the kids who got drafted into that war didn't have any choice by and large. You know, most of the soldiers that were, she said this to me, you know, she's like a 80-year-old woman. She said this to me, like, I know that most of the American soldiers that were there, they were drafted. They didn't want to be there. I know that a lot of American people opposed the war. She's not mad at the United States of American people. She's mad at the United States of American state. Mm. And it's really amazing to me that they make that distinction.
Yeah.
That's a lot more intelligent than most, a lot of Swedish people at least, who, you know, equate being a Muslim with being an Islamic fundamentalist who wants to kill everyone and doesn't, like, just the concept of, like, if you've been drafted by the Islamic State or some other fundamentalist group and you didn't want to be there, but, you know, you were kind of forced to,
mm-hmm.
like, if that ever comes out, you're, I mean, you people will never accept you, even if you were, like, there involuntarily.
Yeah. It's definitely it's a double standard, I guess is the best way to put it. You know, and the United States definitely has that double standard because we, for 20 years, and that's the other thing. And when I was in school, I learned that the Vietnam War, as we call it in the U.S., started in 1965, but we were there in the 50s, in the early 50s. You know, we were actively supporting the French with American troops. For 20 plus years, we were engaged in a terroristic war of oppression and invasion. And, you know, but we don't blame, first of all, we don't even recognize that that's the case to begin with. But, you know, even the people that do, we don't blame the soldiers that got drafted.
Mm.
But of course, if some poor kid in, you know, Syria gets literally kidnapped and turned into like a child soldier, you know, then once they grow up, then they're forever in our minds a terrorist. And there's like no redemption from that. It's an otherization. It's a major, because I think just to a great extent, we don't treat them as, we don't think of them. I'm saying collectively, you know, like we in the developed world don't think of them as humans in the same way that we think of other people from other developed nations.
Have you seen the Ken Burns documentary about the Vietnam War? By chance,
I haven't yet. We really want to see it, but it's like everyone tells us it's pretty heavy. Well, I'm more worried about it just being like kind of depressing, and it's like 12 hours long. So it's like we need to just pick a week that will be a, you know, predetermined sad week.
Yes, yeah. No, but it's you know really I mean? Good actually. I was very surprised. It goes into great detail in how America was involved and France was involved way before it's been established that the Vietnamese War began, and it features all these incredible personal stories. Like the one you just told from Vietnamese people from the north and from the south and like the American soldiers.
I really want to see it because I heard that there are a lot of North Vietnamese people who have never been interviewed before.
Oh, yeah. Like army generals and stuff. And it's so good.
Yeah, I really want to see that. Hmm. Vo Nguyen Giap, who is the great general of Vietnam and considered by many to be one of the greatest military minds in general in history. So his personal secretary is my dermatologist.
That's amazing.
It's like the 6 degrees of Vo Nguyen Giap.
Yeah. It's like in Goodbye Lenin when the former cosmonaut who was out in space becomes a taxi driver.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and of course, God. You know who else became a taxi driver is Nestor Makhno. He like lived out his last days as a taxi driver in Paris, which I always thought was very sad.
Oh, yeah.
Goodbye Lenin's a great movie.
He did go to Paris, yeah.
Forgot about that. I need to rewatch Goodbye Lenin as a leftist. It's funny when you become a leftist, like you have to go rewatch all these movies and like...
Yeah.
Reassess.
Goodbye Lenin is honestly probably my favorite like movie about communism or like the East
ever. Mine too, actually. Yeah, I just rewatched it with my German girlfriend and she thought it was hilarious too.
It was very funny. I do remember that.
It's great. I think it's such a good movie.
It is. No, and it's kind of a love letter to the whole nostalgia thing where it's like the nostalgia for the East. But then also mixed in with this very drab reality of reunification. And you see people in the East become increasingly disillusioned with the West and all these ideals they had about how, oh, everything's going to be great now kind of evaporates as everyone's fired and like everything just turns to just this nightmare of capitalist requirements of, and people are just drafted from the rest of Germany into the East to take their jobs. And it's pretty sad in a way.
And I remember when I watched it, I was actually doing a shitload of wedding videos, and there's the whole like plot about how the guy's doing these like I don't know if they were wedding videos. I think he did
karaoke the guy, videos or something. On the side of working as a satellite dish installer, he does terrible wedding videos or is like pretentiously
I remember being
adding
like,
in references
like
to 2001
so...
and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I was so like empathizing with him. I was just like, yes, that is what it's like.
So one of the questions that I really wanted to touch upon was how you as an anarcho-communist view the Vietnamese political and democratic system.
Mm.
Like, So I don't really know anything about how the Vietnamese democratic system works. I assume it works similar to a lot of Marxist-Leninist countries, how, you know, in the past and in the present work is, you know, based on kind of local constituencies like neighborhoods in public meetings selecting candidates who then go on to run in like municipal elections, and then from there they can go on to like regional and national elections and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And like the whole like political parties and like campaign promises, that kind of stuff is not really involved. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're pretty much like hit the nail on the head. It's basically the Soviet style, and same thing that kind of they do in China, where it's like you have local elections, and then whoever you vote in for your local representative, they vote together for like the whatever they would call a state, you know, or a province or whatever. And then that next level would vote the next. So it's like the textbook definition of a hierarchy. So, you know, by the time you get to the National Assembly, like only very top high level people are voting for National Assembly members. And then only the National Assembly members can vote for the president. So, yeah, I don't dig that.
Do you have, do you have mass organizations?
They have, well, yeah, it's all kind of tied into the state. So for instance, they have, it is required for every company in Vietnam to have a union. And the unions have to be affiliated with the state, but that's not to say that they're like state run. They have autonomy in the sense that they can go on strike whenever they want. They can like create their own bylaws. You know, it's not unlike in the, I don't know about, European unions, but in the USA, every union has to be affiliated with the American Federation, the Bureau of Labor, the United States Bureau of Labor, which is a government. Yeah. It's like a state department. And they have to follow the rules for like certain things about organization and how they collect dues and all that kind of thing. So they do that it's really not that different really than the United States, except for the fact that every company is required to be unionized, and they do have a lot of strikes. They have strikes like pretty much every day. They'll have some like small scale strikes. They've had major mass strikes. I think a year or two ago, there was one of the biggest strikes in Asia ever. Was in Vietnam against a Taiwanese company. I can't remember the name of the company, but they have
Foxconn.
It might have been Foxconn. I'm not sure, but it was a big like a software company or something like that. They were, you know, or a hardware company. They were manufacturing.
That might have been Foxconn then. Yeah,
yeah. They have a lot of strikes. They have a lot of they have a lot of just like political demonstrations. There's student unions. Like every student has to be a member of a student union. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
And
do you have like a women's federation?
Yeah, there's a women's union. Yeah, yeah. And and that's actually a big deal. I mean, they actually do have a lot of power there, and they've made a lot of social progress. I mean, Vietnam is going through a Me Too movement right now, and Luna of Luna Oi, who's my partner on the channel, wrote an article last year about the Me Too movement in Vietnam. It's very fascinating the way it's happening. They're going through this their own progressive movement. Trans people are working. I interviewed a trans woman in Hanoi a couple of times. Her name's Hamin, and she talks a lot about how basically the government is trying to create trans rights in Vietnam. They're trying to create the problem is that they just don't have like and this is the problem with bureaucracy and this kind of hierarchical system is that like so she said they the what she said is that the government is actively trying to make it possible for trans people to get free reassignment surgeries, but a barrier to that is that they currently don't have any kind of bureaucratic mechanism to change somebody's gender on their ID. If that gives you a sense of like some of the problems with the state apparatus, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's not that there's a, like a resistance to trans people getting rights here. It's that there's a lot of bureaucratic bullshit that has to be waded through.
The same thing kind of went down in Denmark, because we have a very strange system of identifying people where in our personal ID numbers, women have their numbers end in an equal number and men's end in an uneven number. So it's
it's the same here, actually. Yeah,
yeah, wow. But I think they fixed it somehow. They just give you a new number.
Yeah, you can change your personal if you change your legal gender, your personal ID number also changes.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, now it does.
I wonder what they would. I guess they'd have to come up with like something else for non-binary or something. I don't know. That's the thing is like, I want to make this clear. Like the problems that Vietnam has are like the same kinds of problems that any developed country has, or, you know, like the United States has. I would say it's a far better system in Vietnam than we have in the United States. I know that's a very low bar, you know, but
in a lot
things
of ways,
work
probably
better
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
I mean, the things here's what I'd say. The problems with Vietnam every problem they have here really is tied to capitalism. And all the things that are getting worse about Vietnam are tied to capitalism. And all the things that work really great in this country are socialist policies. I mean, the socialism that they have here works really, really well. They have price stabilization. So in the US, you would call this a price control, but here they call it price stabilization, which I think is a better name. They have the best price stabilizations in the world, I would argue. Like the price of food and medicine and the things that they price stabilize here, school supplies, housing to some extent. It's like all that stuff is incredibly affordable, even for like the poorest workers. You know,
I remember reading a thing about how there was a shortage of, I can't remember if it was meat or rice or something in Asia, and it didn't really affect Vietnam at all.
Because pork. It was pork. That was just a few months ago. Yeah, like we had to read it in the newspaper because we didn't know. Like, and because there was this big swine disease and it affected all of Asia, and Vietnam was hit by it too. So like thousands and thousands of Vietnamese pigs were dying from this disease, but we didn't even know because the price stabilization is so good here that like we were going to the grocery store and buying pork at the same price as we always had. Whereas that's right incredible. Next door in Cambodia and over in Thailand and in Laos and in China, pork price was like skyrocketing, and we didn't even know until we saw it in the newspaper. So they do a really good job with that stuff. And Luna actually, go ahead.
I follow the South China Morning Post on YouTube, and they published a video that had like gone viral of like a bunch of grandmas in some rural town in China fighting over like the last piece of discounted pork.
Yeah.
Which had like gotten like millions of views in China.
Gotta get that pork.
Yeah. Gotta get that pork. Yeah, it was like a giant piece of pork, though. Like, they could have cut it up and like shared it between them, but no, all those grandmas wanted the whole thing.
Gotta have that pork. I mean,
grandma individualism.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta make the stew for the grandchildren.
That's true.
You have 16 grandkids.
That's
right.
Got a lot of mouths to feed. but yeah, it's you never see like that kind of stuff in Vietnam. Luna's doing a video right now, so if anybody's listening to this, it'll probably be out by the time you hear this. That will kind of explain how the price stabilization in Vietnam works, and it's really, really fascinating. So she can kind of fill in a lot of the gaps there. But the social, that's not the only thing. The education here is incredibly cheap. So Luna's entire college education was, I think, less than $1,000. I think it was like $800 or something like that. And that's because it's like, you know, she went to the best school, one of the best schools in Vietnam. It's the best business school in Vietnam, in Hanoi, you know, like a major college. It was like less than $1,000 for her entire 4 year. That's like all in. It was like less than $1,000. She said,
room and board and books as well.
Yeah. Cause I asked her like, did you ever apply for any scholarships? And she was like, it wasn't really worth it. Cause it's so cheap. She's just like, it wasn't worth the time to apply for scholarships. Same goes for healthcare. I mean, you do have to have insurance here in Vietnam, but the state provides insurance to citizens. And so like Luna pays, I don't even remember, but it's like less than $100 a year for really good insurance. I don't even have, I'm waiting for, like, I have this, insurance policy I just bought. It hasn't kicked in yet. So, it'll kick in a few months, but, even without insurance, I'll go to like the nicest hospital in the city. And I got like operation on my elbow from a pretty bad infection I had, and the whole operation and everything and x-rays and everything, it was like $90. So that was without insurance.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine healthcare that cheap. That's
amazing. Yeah. I mean, I got fillings in my teeth, you know, fillings in your teeth cost like 10 or 15 bucks a piece. That's without insurance again.
Wow.
It's amazing. I tell people all the time, like, cause I see comrades on Twitter who are like desperately in pain and suffering because they can't afford to get dental work. And I'm like, cause it would cost them like $4,000-$6,000 to get some kind of like root canal and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I tell them like, you can fly to Vietnam, get the work done, and then take like a vacation for a week, and you'll spend like less than half as much as you would. That's just incredible. Getting the procedure done in the US.
I heard this statistic, or like this, it's almost like a joke, but mathematically, if you broke your hip, you could replace it in the United States, or you could book a flight to Spain, get your hip replaced in Spain, go live in Madrid for like, I think it was 4 weeks, get trampled by bulls, get your hip replaced again, and then fly back to the U.S. for the same price.
That wouldn't surprise me. It's a nightmare. The U.S. is a nightmare. I mean, it's so bad. But Vietnam doesn't have those problems. I mean, there are certain things that are expensive. So, like, for instance, I do know from, like, researching my insurance policy, if I got cancer, like, you know, like some kind of fairly bad cancer here, that could cost like $20,000 if you don't have insurance. But I mean, that's versus in the US where it would be like $250,000 for the same kind of procedure. Cause I looked, I compared.
I mean, like, know, I wanted to say too, like, I had a wisdom tooth pulled out and I still paid like $1,000 in Denmark. So that's incredible that you can.
And y'all have that Scandinavian socialism stuff going on there.
We're communists and stuff and we still have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Nordic welfare.
Right. So it's like, yeah, I mean, Vietnam is far from perfect. Now, the problems with Vietnam are the fact that capitalism is actually growing here, right? So, like,
I was gonna ask, do you feel, is Vietnam moving toward the left or toward the right?
It's really hard to say. It's like, I'd say they're kind of like moving dead center, you know? It's like they're growing in both directions because they are improving things like their public transportation system is getting way better. They're about to open a metro line in Hanoi, which is just so amazing to me. I think the one in Saigon will follow shortly after. They're starting to lay the ground for a high speed rail system. They're trying to improve things like their public healthcare system. They're actively and I believe diligently and sincerely working on improving social safety nets and social programs, right? But simultaneously, like, you definitely have like these big corporations building huge property developments and all that kind of thing. Now, property is really interesting in Vietnam because it's against the law for a foreigner to own land in Vietnam, period. There's no foreigner in Vietnam who owns any land. And that includes foreign companies as well. Like if it's a majority foreign owned company, they cannot own land. What they can do is they can lease land for like 99 years, but only a Vietnamese citizen or a Vietnamese company can actually own land. Right. That has really helped them a lot with staving off imperialism. Right. So the way it works is like, if you get, no, it's not even a 99 year, I think it's a 50 year lease. So there's no way for like China, like, you know how China's buying up land all over the world. And that's like a form of financial warfare. Yeah. They can't do that in Vietnam. The best they can do is a 50 year lease. And then the government takes it over, or has the option to, they have the option to like release it, or the option can just take it, or the government can either release it back or they can take it back, after that 50 year lease. So it's like, basically the best you can do is like a condo in Vietnam.
Yeah,
if you're
a
foreigner.
Cuba has a very similar system where I think instead of leasing, what Cuba usually does is they do mixed ownership, so that a foreign company which wants to have land in Cuba, they can sell half of their company to the Cuban government. Like there was like a hotel chain in Spain or something. They wanted to build like a hotel in Havana. And basically, the Cuban government owns half of the hotel and get half of the profit from the hotel. And that was like the deal that they got, like, in order to be allowed to build anything or like own any land in Cuba, like half of it has to be owned by the government.
I wonder what their rake on the cut on Guantanamo Bay is.
Oh, nothing.
I know. That was a bad joke. No, I mean, that's actually, if anything, a better system than Vietnam has. Cause I believe that what a lot of companies do in Vietnam is they'll, like what a lot of foreign, I know that Korean companies do this a lot because I used to have a lot of Korean clients when I was doing marketing here. They'll own like 49% of a business and then that business can buy land. And so they'll just have like a Vietnamese business partner that owns 51%. That's a really, really common thing you see.
Yeah, I was thinking that actually. You could just like pay a Vietnamese person to like buy land for you.
Yeah, that's what they do. But then of course there's always like, it's still protects Vietnam from, you know, there's no way that Korean company or any other kind of foreign company could go in and like take the land, you know, like they can't just unilaterally seize the land. So I think it works reasonably well to stave off imperialism to some extent now, but there's still a lot of imperialism and the way of life here is changing. I think that's the worst sign that I see of capitalism in Vietnam is that I've seen it happen since I moved here. I moved here in 2013, and since then, I've seen a lot of lifestyle changes for Vietnamese people. Like, when I first moved here...
Consumerism and stuff?
Oh, yeah, consumerism, for one thing, for sure. But then also just, like, the work life. So when I first moved here, like, it was a very, like, laid-back kind of place, and people valued their family and their friendships a lot more than, like, their business concerns. Whereas, and in the heaviest imperialism currently in Vietnam is coming from Japan and Korea, and to a lesser extent China. But like the Japanese and Korean work life is, and I can tell you this from working in Korea for a couple years, they're like workaholics. You know, they work in Korea, people are expected to work like 50, 60 hours per week. And it's like, if you're not early, you're late, that kind of shit. That's starting to bleed over and infect into the Vietnamese work life a lot. We're starting to see a lot more of like capitalism and work worship and that sort of thing in Vietnam. It's more of a, at this point, I would say more of like a cultural social problem, and the fact that people are like not enjoying their lives as much. I mean, the thing about it is in it, and you see this, like this happened in Korea. I know, like as companies tend to develop under capitalist conditions, yes, people materially become more wealthy, but they also become less happy. And so you're seeing Vietnam, which has always been ranked pretty high on the World Happy Index, like very high. They're starting to drop, and I attribute that to capitalism. Yeah. So, you know, that's what really concerns me, is the fact that you are, and it's not just foreign companies either. Like there's the, one of the biggest companies in Southeast Asia is called Vingroup. It's a 100% owned by one person who's like a multi-billionaire. And he's got this like empire now where they make, they manufacture cars, they manufacture motorbikes, they have convenience stores, they have property development. They are going out and imperializing like Cambodia, and like there are Vietnamese telecom companies that are imperializing Africa and Myanmar. I mean, so like it's kind of really weird how this, like the capitalist entities in Vietnam are now going out and becoming capitalist imperialists in even poorer countries, you know, as Vietnam is developing. That's kind of a terrifying thing. Like when I was in Myanmar doing a job for about a month, and there were a lot of Vietnamese developments happening, you know, with like Vietnamese corporations coming in and basically imperializing Myanmar. And that's just kind of like really rubs me the wrong way, you know? So it's like, I don't know. I would say that Vietnam is at a crossroads right now, and they're going to have to decide. And I feel like, and I have to, I hope, I really hope deeply. And my sense is that they will. Well, I have, okay, do you want to hear my conspiracy theory? My moonshot conspiracy theory?
Always.
Okay.
We love conspiracy theories. Yeah.
So, like, the rumors are, and I believe these rumors, are that, because I've talked to people who work in Vingroup, and a lot of those people say that Vingroup actually doesn't want to grow as quickly as it is, and that the government, the state, is, like, forcing them to take out these big loans and invest and grow really fast. And my pet conspiracy theory that my heart believes but my mind does not is that the plan is for Vingroup to get huge and like take over all of Vietnam, and then the state will just like nationalize it, and then they'll just have full communism. But I don't think that's actually going to happen. I mean, I don't, the chances of that actually happening are very slim, but it's like my dream, I guess, you know, my pipe dream that will happen.
I really want to see a sitcom with this one Vietnamese guy that buys property for rich Chinese people. Like, meet
yeah,
Dan.
Right.
He's got it all figured out with the Chinese, with the rich Chinese people, but he can't work out his love life. Like, I really want to see him.
You and me both. There's a lot of potential for comedy in Vietnam, actually. It's a little, so when I first moved to Vietnam, since my business collapsed, and, you know, with my business partner sort of going off the deep end or whatever, I ended up, what I did a lot of was freelancing, and I speak a little Korean. I'm like an intermediate Korean speaker. So I had a lot of Korean clients. That was kind of like my niche, and, or my niche. People always get on me how I say that word. My niche was, working with Koreans and helping them with like business consulting and marketing and all that kind of stuff. And they were like constantly stressing out because they were, they wanted the Vietnamese employees to work like they were used to the people working in Korea. And they wouldn't do it. They would like not, they would just refuse to work on weekends, or they would refuse to work overtime without pay and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And the Korean people were just like pulling their hair out, trying to get them to like basically be self-exploit more or whatever. And at the time, you know, that was like 2013, 2014, but I think I've noticed, you know, in my personal observation, over time, they've been worn down by these foreign companies, and you're starting to see a lot more of that, like, work worship and capitalistic individualistic mindset, and people like, you know, submitting themselves to, you know, much deeper exploitation. And you're seeing it a lot even more with like Vietnamese companies now, where a lot of these Vietnamese, like this new generation of Vietnamese entrepreneurs, are starting to be like much shittier bosses than they used to be. And it's, and I'm not just saying this myself. I get this from talking to Vietnamese people, talking to Luna, Luna's friends, the people that I meet out in the street. You know, it's getting worse and people are getting more unhappy here, especially in the big cities. You know, people are you just don't see as much of, like it used to be, if you go out for a walk in the afternoon in Saigon or Hanoi, you would see hundreds of people like sitting outside drinking tea, relaxing in the afternoon, you know, taking it because it's, you know, it's taking a little break, drink some tea, and you just don't see that as much anymore. And you don't see the relaxation like you used to. People used to value that kind of relaxation. And I think that's like human. I think that's it, we need that to be healthy and happy, and they don't really do it as much anymore. And now I talk to people and they're like, you know, we have the same kind of like video game development grindhouses that, you know, you hear about in the United States where, you know, people are having to work extra hours, not getting paid, crunch time. Software developers get a lot of crunch time here. It's starting to really get that kind of developed country kind of mindset.
Video games is interesting because like video games have gotten so much bigger and like the technologies in video games have gotten so crazy and like the development time that's required to go into creating modern video games is incredibly high. Like you need a lot of people working many hours in order to create like Red Dead Redemption 2 and like the really big AAA games.
Yeah.
But they all still cost $60 like they did like 30 years ago.
Right, right.
Like video games, like the price of video games haven't changed. The price of the dollar has changed. Mm-hmm. The video games have remained the same price, which is why a lot of these video game companies have to pay their workers less and provide fewer benefits, because otherwise there would just be no profit in making video games because people, consumers, aren't willing to pay more than $60 for a video game, even if it took like 10 years to develop.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's a terrible business model. Like just across the board, it's a terrible business model. I would say it's an unsustainable. I mean, I often wonder if we're not heading towards some kind of bubble, especially if if they keep mistreating the workers the way that they have been. I mean, I can't see that being sustainable. People are burning out and they're desperate, you know. It's like the new sweatshop, really, in a lot of ways. I mean, since a lot of the sweatshops are starting to close down due to automation, we're starting to see these more like techie kind of sweatshops, and it's just you can only push people so far. I
agree. I do think that something's going to give at some point.
Yeah, it's got to.
And when that happens, like, God knows what's going to happen to the video game industry.
Oh my gosh, the gamers are going to be pissed, you know?
gamers have to rise up.
Gamers have to rise up. And they need to realize that the things that they need to rise up about are not like lesbian video game characters, but, you know, the fact that the people who make the games they love are being tortured, you know? And I'm not really, I don't think I'm misusing that term. I think telling somebody they have a crunch time where they're going to have to work 6 days straight without sleeping, as we often hear stories like that, that's a form of torture. Yeah. You know, I mean, like, come on.
And
have some respect for the people that make the things that you love, you know, like value those people and support them. If you're a gamer, and I play video games myself, you know, if you're a gamer, then, you should value the work and the happiness and the work conditions of the people who are making the stuff that you love doing every day. You know, it seems so obvious.
Support indie developers.
Oh yeah.
And like artists and like make their own video games and stuff. Like Temi Tuyoki, who worked on Undertale, is now working on a game of her own. And like Toby Fox, who's like a giant now, but he's like still indie. Like he doesn't have his own company or anything. Like support those people.
Yeah,
they need help.
Or Dong Nguyen, Dong Nguyen, the creator of Flappy Bird, who lives here in Hanoi. who I think might be a comrade, perhaps. I don't know if you've ever heard the story about this, but like the creator of Flappy Bird did not expect it to get so huge, and
he took it down.
Was very uncomfortable with it. Yeah, like it was. Yeah. It's pretty funny that whole story. But yeah, he lives in Hanoi. I think that's pretty funny.
That's cool.
Wish more creators were like that. Had some ethics and some. And in terms of like the actual owners of the properties, but I think the cooperative business model will probably start to really grow and take root in the video game dev world because we've already seen some early like success stories, and I think that a lot of developers will just naturally see those success stories and they'll say, "What's stopping?" Like they'll look around at their coworkers and they'll say, "What's stopping us from doing that?" You know, yeah. like the five of us could make an awesome video game. And I think we're going to see more co-ops coming out of this. And I hope to see more unions as well. I mean, that's got to happen. We've got to get unionization.
Video game unions and stuff. But I think a lot of, I think especially PC gamers who, like a lot of PC gamers love indie games and get indie games. Not necessarily because they're like, oh, I want to support the little guy, but because people who create indie games aren't restricted creatively by like fucking EA or whatever. Like they are free to make whatever that they want, like their creative vision is. And I think like a cooperative would also be very free to be able to, you know, make good products that are like art and not just fucking Call of Duty shooter or whatever that's least pumped up for the sake of making money.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing is like, and this is what I really hope that like we can communicate to people is that under socialism, that's what everything will be like. Everything will be more creative and more and made with more love and made with more passion. And everybody will
be unique.
Yes, like more, exactly. Will there be more diversity?
Like if you've seen Peter, the movies of the Soviet Union, they were incredible.
Yeah, yeah, I was just gonna say, like Peter, you often talk about like the movie techniques and stuff made up in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, like they were pioneers, and all the stuff that we praise people like Kubrick for doing and Scorsese and stuff, it's heavily influenced by the art forms and the experimentation of the Soviet Union. Like Tarkovsky is one of the most visually referenced movie directors of all time by everyone from Fincher to Kubrick. I mean, it's incredible how much if you don't have that capitalist meddling to include like brands and certain themes and like a certain type of music and like everything is so detailed managed in Hollywood in a way that it simply wasn't in the Soviet Union. Like George Lucas proudly said and stands by to this day that he wishes he could have made Star Wars in the Soviet Union because he could have made a movie that was way more representative of what he wanted to make, but simply couldn't because of the capitalist system he was working within.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I heard something that it might have been a rumor, but I like that there was a quote that like Star Wars was made to like represent the Vietnam War, where the rebels were the Viet Cong.
Yeah,
and the
Oh yeah, he's said as much in interviews. Yeah, that it's a Vietnam allegory in its essence.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty. It's once you like learn that and you watch the movies again, it's so clear.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I remember watching when I was in, because I did study film when I was in college, and I remember one of my professors showed us Battleship Potemkin.
Oh,
and then,
I love
like,
that movie.
And then like showed us maybe four or five other films that were made in like Hollywood in 1925, you know, the same year that came out. And it was just like watching like children, like a high school play, and then watching like a Broadway play. It was like Potemkin was like so many leagues above what Hollywood was doing in 1925 in terms of the technical stuff and the acting and everything. It was just so amazing. Like, so Eisenstein
was completely, and still is, one of the best directors of all time.
Yeah. And like, it was a silent movie, you know. It's like, it's just amazing when you see it. Also, have you ever seen the Soviet, you could just Google it, like Soviet arcades. They had these like really awesome, they were mechanical. So they had these like mechanical games. You know, so the U.S. was kind of like fascinated with like the video game with like a TV screen. But in the Soviet Union, they had these amazing arcades, but they were all like mechanical games. So they were like, you would actually be like physically manipulating things. You know, it was kind of like pinball on steroids. So you'd have a shooting game where you'd actually be like shooting things with a real gun, or like a submarine game where you'd actually be like having these little physical submarines moving around. It was really cool stuff. And I always wonder if the Soviets won the Cold War, like video games would look so different. Because instead of having it all on your computer, we would probably have these like fucking crazy like physically built environments. We'd all be like walking around. I can't even imagine what it would be like if that just kept advancing.
But American, would we have virtual reality porn?
We would probably have sex robots. I guess that would be the logical conclusion, right? Like, I guess we would have sex robots in the Soviet Union of like 2020. Right?
I mean, the East made porn illegal, so I don't know if that would happen. But
I'm sure they would have legalized it at some point. Like, let's be honest.
You can legalize robot porn.
Maybe.
Come on.
Yes. Yeah, I guess.
It's a victimless crime.
It's not exploiting anyone.
Victimless crime. Just metal against metal.
Prostitution might not be a victimless crime, but robot prostitution? I'm just saying.
But what about the robot pimps?
I didn't think about the robot pimps. And that's
they're brutal, man. Robot pimps.
We're all canceled now. This is our cancellation.
I mean, in 20 years when robots get rights, and then we elect the first robot president of the United States, we will all be canceled.
Oh my God. You got to remember to delete all archives of this recording when the robots take over. I mean, I don't want to mess with the robot tribunals.
Elect me, yeah. Senator Megatron 5000. I will eliminate Mexican robots.
I can't wait to impeach
Mexico
Cyber Trump.
When Mexico produces their robots, they're not producing their best. They're producing raper bots and criminal bots.
That's so bad. We have to build a robot wall.
Firewall.
Firewall.
They call it the firewall.
I get it. I see what you did there.
Yeah.
There was another thing I wanted to say about Vietnam. Two things, actually, that are just like fun tidbits about Vietnam, which, the first one is a lot more fun than the second one. So the first one is that there's a Finnish song, a children's song called Lenin Seta Asu Venijällä, which I think translates to like... Uncle Lenin visits Vietnam. I don't speak Finnish. I'm very sorry, but it's a song recorded in 1972 by this Finnish Marxist Leninist music group, and they said that they took the lyrics from a Vietnamese poem, and I was on a hunt for this poem.
He really has been. He's talked about this for a while. So this is real.
Yeah. And I found it, actually.
You did?
Yeah. It's a poem written by Nhien Hong Tien a friend of mine on my Discord server found it on a Blogspot blog.
Wow.
Just written by some guy who knew the poem from when he was a child.
Wow.
But it's all in Vietnamese. I can't read any of it.
We could get Luna to translate that for you, actually. She'd be
happy
to do
that. That would be awesome.
Okay, incoming Luna. Luna is incoming. We have a question for you about Finland and Vietnam.
Oh, hey, Luna. Hey. Big fans of yours. We love your content.
Oh, really? Hello.
Hello.
We have a question for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's this song, this Finnish song that I've listened to for years. It was written in 1972. It's called Lenin Seta Asu Venijällä. And it was adapted into a song from a Vietnamese poem written by a guy named Nhien Hong Kien, who I don't know when he wrote it, but it's... I sent a link on Google Hangouts to the blog.
Okay, I'll check that. Mm. Ông Lenin. Okay, here we go.
Yeah, Ông Lenin ở nước Nga mà em lại thấy rất là Việt Nam. Oh my God. This is the poem that we study in primary school in the moral, moral subject class.
They have a moral subject class and they have to study this poem.
Yes. It sounds so familiar to me.
So in Finland, they made a song out of this poem that you're familiar with. That's interesting, huh? Is it something that you know by heart or?
Yeah, this is something that I know by heart.
Oh wow!
Yes,
really?
Yes.
Can you do a little brief? Like, can you read the first couple of lines just so we can hear it in the actual Vietnamese?
So here's the original version, Vietnamese version of the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Ông Lenin ở nước Nga mà em lại thấy rất là Việt Nam. Cũng vầng trán rộng thênh thang y như trán bác mênh mông đất trời. Yes, it's exactly the song that I knew.
Oh, Luna, you're gonna have to make the official translation to English, I guess. I think this is like a new project for you.
Yeah, this is I can translate to you like right now. It's so kind of very simple.
Okay.
Like Mr. Lenin from Russia, but I can feel like it's just like Vietnam. And it's that he also has the same big forehead, just like the big forehead of Ho Chi Minh.
That's so adorable. Oh, that's amazing. So Wow, we've really uncovered some amazing stuff here. I think this is really cool. You got like a Finnish Vietnamese comrade connection going on.
American, you know what we have to do now? We have to start a band. We have to sing this song in Vietnamese. We have to top the charts.
Translate it into English.
Luna's an excellent vocalist. Can you sing the song to that in Vietnamese to the tune that you just heard?
Oh my god.
I'm not gonna try it.
Geez, it's so hard because we are tonal language. It's really hard.
We'll give Luna some rehearsal time.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll be for the next episode.
Yeah.
All right. You can get back to us.
I'll play the git fiddle. Asher, you'll take the drums.
I've got an accordion, actually. That's a nice communist instrument.
Hell yeah. So. Oh, this is gonna be great.
I've also got a kazoo.
We can tour Asia.
Yeah.
Go to Cambodia. Well, play on the streets.
Yeah, I thought that would be interesting to see. I'm really glad to hear that you've heard of that before, Luna. I'm glad that this was a successful venture. So
this is in the official textbook, okay? Official textbook of Vietnamese kids.
Yeah. Your official indoctrination manual. Yeah.
It's a very nice song, actually.
I know, it's so sweet. I mean, like,
this
it was
a big forehead
legitimately
game.
Relaxing to
big
me.
Big forehead game.
Well, that's the thing too, is that like in Vietnam, you know, they have deep respect for Ho Chi Minh, but they also, you know, can
kind
like
of,
make fun
like,
of his big forehead.
Yeah, it's nicely not, make fun of him.
It's not like a terrifying thing where like.
And can I just say, in the documentary, the Ken Burns documentary we talked about, he is presented very respectfully, I think, Ho Chi Minh. I gained a lot of respect for him as a person from that documentary. I didn't know a lot about him before I watched the documentary, and I've looked into him afterwards.
Oh.
I think they actually did a very good job of portraying him as this father of his country and someone who really wanted independence for Vietnam. And
I mean, even before the war, he spent his entire life fighting for independence. I mean, he was in prison when he was a teenager.
Mm. It's quite amazing.
So I was kind of very satisfied when I asked an American about how the historical textbook in America described Ho Chi Minh, and he told me that there's nothing bad.
Yeah, so they can't say anything bad about it, really.
Good,
it's funny, because you read about like the Russian communists, and they're like, well, they're evil, and here's all this bad shit. And then like North Korea, they're evil, and here's all this bad shit. And then you get to Cuba and Fidel Castro, and he's evil. And then you get to Vietnam, and it's like, well, Ho Chi Minh, he's trying to help his country, and he didn't really do anything bad. You know about the have you ever heard about the communist fraternal kiss?
Yes.
Did What's they that? Do the fraternal kiss in Vietnam?
I don't know.
Because I know they didn't do it in China.
I don't know if they do, like, normally or whatever, or if they still do, but Luna, your uncle gave me, I think, a communist fraternal kiss. So fraternal means, like, between brothers, right? Oh. So there's this old tradition in like the Soviet Union and stuff where like men would kiss each other, right? Like when they greeted each other. Mm-hmm. And like one of your uncles was one of the guys who was wearing a uniform. I don't know if he was a policeman or a military man or whatever. It was an old guy.
Oh.
And he kissed me on the cheek.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's the man who like the leader of my family or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, he used to be a soldier. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that something that happens in Vietnam a lot where like.
I guess I didn't know about that.
It's like an old communist tradition. It goes back a long time. So.
Yeah. Because I know that like in Eastern Europe between the communist nations, like there's the very famous photograph of Leonid Brezhnev and Erich Honecker, who like are deeply embraced in a socialist fraternity kiss.
Yeah.
But when the Soviet statesmen politicians from the Eastern Bloc would go to China, even like before the Sino-Soviet split, when they were still like comrades.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets, the Russians wanted to do the socialist fraternity kiss with the Chinese, but they like in their culture, that's very like, they were very like, no, that's not going to fly.
Yeah.
And so I think they came to like the, after like weeks or months of like serious political discussion, like sitting down in meetings about this,
oh my God.
They were like, the Chinese were like, okay, we will agree that the Russians can hug. We can embrace in a deep hug, and then the Russians can kiss us on the cheek, provided that we do not have to kiss them back.
I wish the Soviet had been like, nah, I gotta have those lips.
So that's the best they can do, huh? That's the best.
That must be...
Like,
I would,
you
to
can
be
a, kiss me, all right, but I am not gonna kiss you back.
I would love to be a fly on the wall during those negotiations. Holy shit.
Could you imagine?
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean...
The Chinese just wanted to bow. And then they were like, okay, we can maybe shake hands. Yeah, and then after like discussion, they were like, all right, fine. You can hug us and then you can kiss us on the cheek.
But is,
that's it. Well, yeah. Luna knows more about Chinese culture than me, but I think in China, they don't even like hold hands with their spouses in public.
It's something about related to Confucianism.
Mm. Yeah.
They try to avoid the kind of the body touching. They try to avoid.
Especially in public. Yeah.
Yeah, especially in public and especially between men and women.
It's an ethics thing, right? And morality, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Confucius, yeah.
I was just, that picture of, who'd you say was Brezhnev and Honecker? Yeah, just to put that into context, that was used by the US and England and other countries as like a gay panic scare tactic against communists at the time.
Like, look at these gay guys.
Yeah, exactly. Look at these gay guys. Gay guys are running countries.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Soviet Union is run by gay. Yeah.
I don't know if Luna's familiar with this. I'm showing Luna the picture. So this is like it was like an old socialist thing.
Wow.
It's kind of sweet,
lips.
I think. Yeah.
Wow.
It's like
bros being bros.
The guy with the eyebrows is Leonid Brezhnev, the general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And the other guy is Erich Honecker, who was general secretary of the Socialist Unity Party in East Germany.
Hmm.
I like it. I think we should bring it back.
Yeah.
Let's reclaim it.
Well, because I mean, the Soviet Union would have sent diplomats to Vietnam. So I'm just curious, like, did they do it there? Because like...
Luna, we've got some research projects.
The Soviets would have wanted to, but maybe the Vietnamese were like, no, we don't want to do that. Or
did the guys kiss or not?
Yeah.
Did they?
I'm interested. I want to know.
Kissing going on?
I want to know if a Soviet leader ever kissed Ho Chi Minh on the mouth.
Probably not Ho Chi Minh, though, right?
I saw the picture. Yeah, I saw. But they kiss on their cheeks.
Okay. Oh.
Not on their lips. Okay. Their cheeks. I remember that. Like, even until now, like, mostly all the guys, the old man in the government, and Vietnam, they kiss in their cheeks.
Oh, yeah. I see a picture right here of Ho Chi Minh kissing a guy on the cheek.
That's interesting. I wonder if the Cubans do that.
They use both. Yeah, he used both of his hands to hold that guy's face and kiss him.
Yeah, it's like a very, like vigorous kiss.
Thank you so much for sticking with us through this conversation. We hope that it's been cool. And thank you so much to American for joining us. This has been a blast.
Yeah.
I hope we get to talk again some other time. There's still a bunch to talk about Vietnam that we didn't get to.
Yeah.
And it would be awesome to talk more about your views on politics and Vietnam and everything. So
yeah, anytime.
Yeah. I mean, chances are if you know this channel, you know Non-Compete, the fun channel, which does great content, leftist, Marxist, libertarian, socialist, whatever you want to call it, content. Check it out if you haven't. If you're somehow someone who's familiar with us and not American, check out his channel. He's done some very funny, very good videos about Marxism and leftism and the world today. And check out Luna, too, who is working with American, doing the online videos and does great content of her own. So thank you so much for joining us today. And have a good day, night, or week, or whatever.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Have fun. Bye-bye.